The Northern Ireland Protocol remains a sticking point between the UK and the EU. The British Foreign Secretary claims that London's plan to override some post-Brexit trade rules does not break international law, and there is no reason for the EU to take legal action over the UK's plans to change parts of the agreement. And that after the bloc threatened against London's unilateral revision of Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trade arrangements. Britain has introduced legislation that would remove customs checks on some goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. The EU calls this a violation of the deal. The EU Commission is considering reopening a suspended infringement procedure against Britain. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode of the program. Journalist and commentator James Tweedy joining us out of Plymouth. Also with us will be journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes out of Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Now, starting with James, the EU's threatening with legal action. As you heard, the US is urging negotiations, Prime Minister Johnson claiming that there is no other way to protect the peace process. Such a mess, isn't it?
Well, it's gotten that way. The question is, on what basis are we going to take legal action? The accusation against Britain is that this would be a breach of international law, but that doesn't really stand up, I don't think, because the action that Britain is going to take is essentially to invoke Article 16 of the Protocol. It's not a breach of the treaty because it's part of the treaty. And that, if you read us, describe that as tearing up the treaty, but it obviously is not. What it means is that you, including the EU, take action, the protocol or the fine, if trade, if it's free trade. But then they've got to give the...
Okay. Unfortunately, we lost that connection. So let me go to Fra Hughes. Fra, the Northern Ireland Protocol is a crucial part of the post-Brexit trade agreement. So what are the chances of a trade war between Britain and the EU now that the legislation overrides parts of the Brexit deal?
I think it's important that it's quite possible that there could be a trade war not only with the European Union, but also with America. I believe it was Nancy Pelosi stated that if Britain introduced unilateral changes to the agreed Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol, but that would endanger any future trade agreements with the United Kingdom, between the United Kingdom and the USA. But I think what we have here is a case of the tail wagging the dog. There's nothing in these changes that are really in the interests of the people of Great Britain, that being Scotland, England and Wales, as the Northern Ireland Protocol does not affect them. Mm. What it does affect is a small section of society here who want to remain pro-British. They are the British settler colonial residents from several hundred years ago. These people are the ones who are dictating what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. We have the DUP as the regional kind of political representatives of working class middle class loyalists and unionists refusing to go into the regional assembly at Stormont, and without them you cannot have a functioning devolved assembly without cross community bilateral support. We also have threats of violence from loyalist paramilitaries in the background, and indeed only last week a man was stopped on the Shankill Road as someone by the name of Winston Irvine, who had two firearms and 200 bullets in the boot of his car. So I think this is more to do with appeasing unionism and loyalism than it has anything to do with upholding the sovereign rights that the UK says is at the forefront of these further needed and required negotiations.
Okay. James, the embattled British Prime Minister is saying that the proposed changes are relatively trivial. The EU firmly opposes the move. It says that the unilateral action is a clear breach of international law. How do you look at this?
Okay, look, the argument that Johnson knew what he was signing up for was not naive and knew that the Northern Ireland Protocol would mean this that's about that holds water. The European Union's this is going to somehow undermine that it's necessary, that the protocol is even necessary, is questionable in itself, because the protocol, let's say, it keeps Northern Ireland in the EU's internal market and therefore not in the British trade jurisdiction, let's say. And the argument for that is that they don't, and it restricts the flow of goods from the UK into Northern Ireland, the rest of the UK into Northern Ireland. And their argument is that Britain, might use, if they don't have customs checks on those goods, the UK might be able to smuggle goods into the EU. Well, that's not going to work, is it? That doesn't fly, because most of the trade that goes between Britain and Ireland, the island of Ireland, as they say, goes to the Republic. It goes through Dublin and other ports, and comes back the other way, by the way. And very little passes over that land border between the six counties, as they say, and the Republic. What goes over is local traffic. So that's a canard. The EU has, the EU is not innocent here. They've been refusing to negotiate on this, and the British government's accusation in that regard is valid. What else can we say? Britain is talking about invoking Article 16 of the treaty. It's in the treaty, And what does it mean? Right. Well, it means that either side can make changes if it's disrupting trade or if it's disrupting social cohesion. Now, the British government says, well, yeah, it is, because people are rioting about this. And you may say, well, the people who are rioting are unionists, and the unionists are opposed to the protocol, and, they're creating the conditions, but, it's there. I mean, by the way, when the protocol was being, and the whole withdrawal agreement was being negotiated, Sinn Féin threatened, well, they said, they warned, not threatened particularly, they warned that there would be a return to violence if the hard border imposed between Northern Ireland and the Republic. Uh-huh. That warning sounds a lot like a threat. It's not a very credible threat, because the Belfast Peace Agreement was signed back in 1998, and the people who were fighting are rather old now. Probably don't want to go back to any kind of violence. Most of them. Also the UK was not the one threatening to impose a hard border, it was the EU that was talking about that. The thing is, it's a mess. Boris Johnson, who directly negotiated this with Ursula von der Leyen, is responsible for signing it.
Right.
Boris Johnson is not the only person affected by it. And, he may... it's up to the people of Northern Ireland. There's a lot of talk also about the Good Friday Agreement comes into it. The idea that there mustn't be a hard border is supposedly written into the, it's an interpretation of the Good Friday Agreement, but the Good Friday Agreement is not just for the Republican community in Northern Ireland, it's also for the Unionists, because the also the Unionist paramilitary involved in the conflict. You know, someone to form, you know, parties to get together, because no party has a majority in the Stormont Assembly, and form a, you know, form a government, and, and, you know, allow politics to proceed the way it does in you know, every other country.
Okay, Boris Johnson has defied all the criticisms coming going his way, and he published legislation to, as some people call it, rip up the Brexit, and insists that there is no other way to protect the peace process in Northern Ireland. Is there really no other way?
Well, let's look at that question in its entirety. What is the threat to the Northern Ireland peace process? The majority of people here voted to remain within the European Union. The majority of elected representatives of the people at Stormont, the regional Northern Ireland Assembly, are happy with the Northern Ireland Protocol. So the only people threatening the stability of the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement, and peace that we have lived with and through for the last 30-odd years, or whatever it happens to be, the only threat to that is from militant unionism and from loyalist paramilitaries. And as soon as people accept that to be the complete and real truth of the situation, and the sooner the British government and others face down the threat of loyalist violence, which is hanging in the background, we are marking a centenary of 100 years of partition on the island of Ireland, brought to us by British guns and by guns of loyalist paramilitaries of the Ulster Volunteer Force of 1912. And people after that. So they are the threat to the peace process. If people want peace and stability, leave the Northern Ireland Protocol alone. It's been agreed with the British government. It's been agreed with 26 other countries within the European Union. Face down loyalist extremists. And within 15 years, it's quite possible Ireland will be reunified, and this will not be a problem, because the whole country will probably be in its entirety out of the United Kingdom and completely within the European Union.
Okay. James, Northern Ireland's unionists have refused to join a power-sharing government in Belfast with Sinn Féin that you mentioned, unless the protocol that covers trading arrangements in the region is rewritten. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Okay. I mean, like I was saying earlier, power sharing is part of the Good Friday Agreement, but, you know, you may ask what's so good about the Good Friday Agreement in that regard. And, you know, as my fellow guest said, he's arguing that the majority of members of the Stormont Assembly are in favor of the protocol. I'll get into that in a minute. Well, why not allow them to form a majority government then, instead of having this power-sharing thing, which is a political fudge? I mean, you only have this there's no real need for it, let's say. But, I mean, you go a bit further with this. I mean, who really wants the protocol? I mean, Sinn Féin doesn't want the protocol. It wants reunification, and Irish reunification, and that is one solution to the problem. But another solution would be for the Republic of Ireland to leave the EU. It might be easier, in fact, because for reunification, you have to have a majority on both sides of the border in favour of it. And Ireland leaving the EU would only require a referendum in the south. Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, trades a lot more with the UK than it does with the EU. So actually, the Republic being outside of the EU would be beneficial for it. And now it's also, since Britain has left and EU tax income has gone down, you know, tax income from the member states to Brussels has gone down, and Ireland is now a net sort of payer in to the EU treasury as well. So this isn't a great situation. And the EU hasn't really been kind to the Republic of Ireland over the years either. So, yeah, okay. Look at some of the other parties. I mean, the DUP doesn't want the protocol. The DUP wants, you know, Northern Ireland to stay part of the UK forever. Other parties, the SDLP, they don't want the protocol. They want Britain back in the EU, don't they? Because they, you know, they probably did quite well off the whole European Parliament gravy train.
Okay.
So that's what they want, you know. Nobody really, I don't think they really want the protocol. They have other ulterior motives. And using Brexit or the situation of Brexit as to sort of piggyback, or, you know, piggyback, yeah, Irish reunification onto, that's likely to be problematic. You know what I mean? People are not going to be satisfied with that.
Okay, James, Fry doesn't seem to agree with you. Let him now.
By all means, have a border poll, as they say, a referendum on the issue of reunification, but don't link it to Brexit, and don't link it to the EU, because the EU, you know, it's problematic in a lot of ways.
It's Fry's time now.
The EU is becoming synonymous with NATO.
Okay, James.
The Republic of Ireland is not a member of NATO.
Okay, Fry's turn. Go ahead, Fry.
Has, you know, been allowing the U.S.
I'd like to say about power sharing, as part of the mechanism to bring about a united government at Stormont, they brought in the De Hondt principle. Now, I am an Irish Republican Socialist, and I have lived in a country that has been partitioned by the British for 100 years. The first 50 years, up until 1970, votes were based not from one person, one vote. We had a gerrymandered state that gave a pro-British, pro-Protestant, pro-Unionist majority at the regime. In Stormont, we had a one-party, 10-pot semi-dictatorship for 50 years, which led to the civil rights movement, which led to a demand for equality within the north of Ireland, within its institutions. This led to violence on the streets of Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland, and led to 25 to 30 years of conflict. But the Hunt mechanism is there to prevent unionists rejoining. There are separate strands of unionism represented at the regional assembly. If they join together in some form of a democratic government, what they would do is reinstitute the sectarian discriminations that people of my generation and above suffered for over 50 years. So without power sharing, there will be no devolved assembly. The people of Ireland are very much in favour of the EU. Personally, I am not in favour of the EU. I voted for Brexit. I believe in national sovereignty, but I am not stupid and I am not naive. I live in this country. I know the politics. I know the sectarian nature, and I know that it is loyalist extremism that is forcing the British government to renegotiate the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Okay, James, sorry for the interruption, but we have only 2-3 minutes for each question. I have to handle this. We've talked about Ireland enough. Let's talk about Scotland. You know, Nicola Sturgeon, James, is talking about holding a second independence vote from Britain by the end of next year. And she's arguing that Scotland will be better off outside of the UK. Is she right?
No, not at all. I mean, she doesn't. The Scottish government, the Scottish devolved administration, and the Scottish Parliament, they don't have the power to call a referendum. So what they're talking about would be, you know, it would be like a kind of protest thing, just like they did in Catalonia a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Except this time, probably, you know, unlike in Catalonia, they probably won't arrest Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP leadership. But Scotland, about 60% of the goods that are produced in Scotland are sold in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And about less than a third as much of that is exported to EU member states. So no, it wouldn't. And Sturgeon was forced to admit today that they would have the same problem as with Northern Ireland currently if they left, if they became independent from Britain, they would be in the EU common market and Britain would not, and you'd have to have tariffs and customs checks and so forth at the border. Mm-hmm. Maybe not tariffs if the free trade agreement holds up, but you'd have to have customs checks, so there would be problems with moving goods. And there are people who live on one side of the, you know, the border, as they say, which is not a border, between Scotland, the historic border between Scotland and England, and work on the other side. And they would be, you know, they would be citizens of different countries, and they would have to go through passport control to go to work and back every day. You know what I mean? It's a ridiculous idea. You know, the two countries are economically and socially integrated for hundreds of years.
Okay.
And it is ridiculous to talk about separating them. I mean, just as, you know, there are 1 million Irish people living in the UK and 200,000
okay, James,
UK citizens living in the Republic of Ireland.
Okay, James, if you allow me, we're running out of time. We have only 1 minute and a half for Fry to answer the same questions.
About Scottish independence, I think you're either a Democrat or you're not a Democrat. You either believe that the people of any nation have the right to elect a government to act on their behalf, and if they want independence, that they should have independence. There are 26 countries in the European Union who are all connected in various stages. They all have land borders with each other. I know that through the European Union, those borders are now open, but they have separate languages. They have separate sovereign states. They have separate means of production within all those different countries. I am a Democrat. I believe, like many Scots and many Irish people do, that Scotland and Ireland have been subjugated under British military and political occupation for centuries. If you believe in democracy and the Scottish people want independence, why not let them have a referendum? Why not let them vote for it? And why not say, if you want your freedom and you want your independence and you want your dignity and you vote for it in a referendum and the referendum reaches 51% of the population, then as a Scottish or Irish person, I would demand that that referendum respect.
Okay, interesting discussion, but we're just running out of time very quickly. So thank you, my guest, James Tweedy in Plymouth, and Fry Hughes in Belfast.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, kindness and gentleness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As we all know about the personality of the Holy Prophet, the main character, the most pillar character I will call in Islam is the personality of the Holy Prophet. In whole the system of Islamic teaching and in the whole system of Islamic thinking, the personality of the Holy Prophet is the central, most central personality. If you deny the personality of the Holy Prophet from Islam, nothing remains. What remains will be zero, will be nothing. So he is the most important personality in Islam. And what is the most important character of the Holy Prophet? What is the most central character of the Holy Prophet? It's the kindness. It's the ar-Rahmah. It's the blessing. It's the being kind and gentle to humanity. So this is the core issue of Islam. This is the core thing that binding force of Islam. And even in the life of the Holy Prophet, if you see that the most attractive thing, the most powerful thing which attracted humans towards, the mankind towards this great personality of Islam, the pillar personality of Islam, it's the kindness, it's being gentle to others. So we see in Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَبِمَا رَحْمَةٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ لِنْتَ لَهُمْ وَلَوْ كُنْتَ فَضًّا غَلِيظَ الْقَلْبِ لَنْفَضُّوا مِنْ حَوْلِكَ. It's the act of mercy, it's the blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you are gentle in dealings with them. If you were harsh and hard-hearted, they would have dispersed and left you alone. So here Quran is telling us about a very important point. What is that quality? What is that central binding force that was making Muslim an ummah? a one unit. What was gathering them together, making them a unit? It was the love of Holy Prophet. It was the kindness and gentleness of Holy Prophet. The Quran is telling us the character of Holy Prophet, and this characteristic of Holy Prophet tells us that the gentleness and kindness is actually the foundation of Islamic life. It's the foundation and binding force of Islamic society. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z. We are talking about the personality of the Holy Prophet and the centrality of the quality of kindness in Islam and his personality, and how this quality has this tribute and this quality has the power to come together and bring together the people of Ummah, and how it's most central quality in the Islamic society. So the personality of the Holy Prophet is an example for Muslims, for us, for all of us. So if you want to really manifest this quality in your life, if you want to live a life like Holy Prophet, if you want to say yes and answer to Allah's command that He says, obey your Prophet, if you want to live an Islamic life, if you want to give your share and take part in the society for building an Islamic society, a rational society, be kind to your fellow creatures. Be gentle in your dealing with people. Be gentle in dealing with your family members. In this way, you are becoming a real Muslim. You are actually realizing and making it real the main quality of the Holy Prophet, and that was being gentle. If you do so, and if you will do this, you will find that your life will more become blissful and will more become full of blessings. And you will find that this blessing and this gentleness and this kindness will return to you. So I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He may put the kindness and gentleness for His creatures in our hearts, and we may be able to love and be kind to our fellow humans. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq War dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saeed Pereza, London.
As people in Afghanistan are facing acute hunger, poverty, and deprivation, Kelly Clements, the Deputy High Commissioner for UN Refugee Agency, and her delegation visited Kabul to address the humanitarian situation.
This is a very important moment for this country and the people of Afghanistan. It is a time where the world's attention has turned to other situations of displacement, other war, other conflicts. But the needs of the Afghan people are incredibly important, and it's one of the reasons why I have come here now to this country to see how we can best support the needs of the Afghan people.
The UNHCR commissioner also stressed the need for providing a safe ground in Afghanistan for Afghan refugees who want to return to their country and for the people to enjoy their rights.
In addition to the 3.5 million internally displaced people, women, children, and men, There are 6 million Afghans outside of Afghanistan that want to see a country at peace, that want to see a country that is stable, that is inclusive, and that looks after the needs of its people.
Meanwhile, the Taliban's acting Minister for Refugees Affairs welcomed the delegation and said that Afghanistan is ready to cooperate with the UN bodies and other charities to assist the Afghan people.
We appreciate the UNHCR's work and programs in Afghanistan. We expect the international community and the UN to separate the humanitarian issues from political ones and continue their life-saving assistance to our country. We are fully ready to cooperate with them in all of their projects across the country.
In Afghanistan, war has subsided, but the impacts of drought, sanctions, and cuts in global aid continue to drive people from their homelands to other provinces and countries. The UN officials' visit to Afghanistan comes as the country faces widespread hunger and displacement. Afghans are calling for solidarity and funding from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The day before France votes in their first round legislative elections, rallies were held around the country with two objectives. First, the far right is expected to win their greatest number of seats in 36 years, but that still only means less than 5% of the National Assembly. Second, the biggest question is, will President Emmanuel Macron retain his absolute majority and thus the ability to ram through more austerity-minded legislation? The left and Greens have surprisingly united, and the polls say Macron's coalition might get upset.
This government is not for the French people and for France, but is instead for the destruction of France. And look at the shameful police brutality at the recent Champions League final. That's what Yellow Vest have been enduring since November 17, 2018. And this government has just gotten worse and worse.
The Yellow Vests were a social revolt based around economic issues, and their list of demands are more relevant than ever. Lack of public services, low wages, high taxes, frozen pensions, and the increasing cost of the most essential goods are now major problems across the West. However, despite being the most popular social movement in recent French history, they aren't going to make major political inroads into parliament this election. Even if Macron's coalition doesn't win an outright absolute majority, their right-wing economic philosophy is certain to find support among the mainstream conservative party. They may dwindle to just 10% of seats, but that would be enough to keep parliament controlled by right-wing ideology. As first-round votes are often used for so-called protest votes, the results could be deceiving. The only certainty seems to be that Macronism has lost much of its appeal and momentum since 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Sunday, some 9 million Italians were called to elect mayors and councillors in 971 towns and cities in a vote in which the strength of mainstream political parties has been put to the test before national elections next year. Elections were held in big cities such as Genoa, Verona and Palermo and in hundreds of provincial capitals. The turnout was lower than 50% in most municipalities, as disaffection with political actors and institutions continues to be on the rise. On Sunday, Italians were also called to vote on 5 referenda regarding justice issues. The referenda failed because they did not achieve the required quorum of 50% of voters, a further sign of electors' disenchantment with the country's politics.
The doors of the halls of power have been closed and the people got left out. I cast my ballot today simply to preserve my right to vote. The government should have not held a referendum on such technical justice matters. It's been just a waste of public resources.
Far-right party Brothers of Italy is likely to win the highest number of votes according to polls. The Brothers of Italy was the only party that stayed out of Mario Draghi's government. Nevertheless, the ideological distance between its leader, Giorgia Meloni, and Prime Minister Draghi is narrow. Meloni, a staunch NATO advocate, is supportive of Italy sending arms to Ukraine and of increased spending on defense.
Polling stations had been deserted by voters, not only because of disaffection with politics, but also because the Italian media barely talked about this referendum and local elections. Their focus is the war in Ukraine only. We are sick and tired of politicians' empty promises.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and want the government to work for a peace proposal. Their calls have so far gone utterly unheard. Max Civili, Rome.
Venezuela is one of the farthest countries from Iran, but it's among the closest allies. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has had a busy schedule since he arrived in Iran on Friday. Here, he took a tour of one of Iran's major engineering companies, Mapna Group, where he was warmly welcomed by the Iranian tech firm.
It's a pleasure to have the Honorable Venezuelan President, Mr. Nicolas Maduro, at our company to present some of our capabilities, products, achievements, and our future plans to His Excellency.
Maduro has been in Tehran as part of an official trip that was slated to take 2 days, but later was announced to last for 4 days. Heading a politico-economic delegation, the Venezuelan official and his Iranian counterpart, Ibrahim Raisi, signed a 20-year cooperation agreement on Saturday to expand ties in the oil and petrochemical industries, military and economy.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Iran has been a key player in supplying fuel to energy-hungry Venezuela. Both sanctioned by the United States, Tehran and Caracas has boosted their partnership since 2020, especially in energy projects and oil swaps, helping the South American nation mitigate the impacts of Washington's embargoes. During Maduro's visit, the two sides also agreed to launch direct flights between Caracas and Tehran in order to promote tourism and trade between the two countries.
With shared concerns, shared interests, and a common rival, Tehran and Caracas are poised to push the envelope on their strategic alliance, viewing it as a counterforce to what they call Washington's coercive measures against both nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi-sun and Hyo-soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate. Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thank you.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas, including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago.
Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kudrip, Tehran.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation. But this time, it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by a quarter of 1% next month, most likely a half of 1% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you waste, what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I've had also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma faqbal udhri warham shiddat dhurri wa fukkani min shidd wa thaqi. Brothers and sisters, the part under discussion was this excerpt of the Kumail supplication in which the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam, states, يَا مَنْ بَدَأَ خَلْقِي وَذِكْرِي وَتَرْبِيَتِي وَبِرِّي وَتَغْذِيَتِي O, you who raised in my creation to the remembrance of me, to the nurture of me, to the goodness toward me, and to the nourishment of me. هَبْنِي لِبْتِدَاءِ كَرَمِكَ Bestow upon me, for the sake of you having given rise to me with generosity, وَسَالِفِ بِرِّكَ بِي And your previous goodness to me. Regarding this part that talks about the deserving servant feeling at the door of Almighty Allah's mercy, the truthful, pious, and loving deserving servant who feels that the doors of Almighty Allah's mercy have opened for him. He feels that he is ready to hear his prayer. So the servant states, Habni libtidai karamik, I know you have been kind to me, I know you have been generous to me, and because of your previous generosity to me, please bestow upon me. We said that the servant who has reached this state has realized there is an ontological need toward Allah. There is an inherent need toward Allah. And this will attract the mercy of Allah even before he himself becomes aware of it and raises it to Allah. But now the servant is even closer. He has raised the need toward Allah. And this is the norm and sunnah of the Almighty Allah that applies to all the things in the universe, everything which is functioning in the universe, specifically the mercy of Allah and its relation with the ontological indigence of the creatures. The way the need seeks Allah's mercy is the way mercy is in search of the need. Of course, it should be noted, it should be mentioned, that the beautiful attributes and names of the Almighty Allah are above any need, and His divinity is beyond all needs. But the mercy of Allah seeks the objects of need in indigence. So, what we need to know is His divinity is beyond any miserliness, and the difference in the levels of mercy is because of the difference in the levels of need and indigence brought to him. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this state and in this part of the Kumayas application, is bringing his needs toward his only Lord, mentioning his previous generosities and previous goodnesses, and now asking him to continue to pursue his generosity. Habni libtidai karamik.
Oh Allah, accept my apology and have pity on my intense sufferings and set me free from my heavy fetters. My nourisher, have mercy on the weakness of my body, the delicacy of my skin, and the brittleness of my bones. O He who originated my creation and accorded me my individuality and ensured my upbringing and welfare and provided my sustenance, I beg You to restore Your favors and blessings upon me as You did in the beginning of my life.
Thank You, Allah. So good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So in this part, Imam Ali alayhi salam is asking his Lord, Habni libtida'i karamik wa salifi birrikabi, bestow upon me for the sake of You having given rise to me with generosity and Your previous goodness to me. We concluded that the natural bringing of the need toward Almighty Allah inherently attracts His mercy. The land needs heat, light, water, and air for its growth, and Allah the Exalted grants her with what it needs. And this need of her is an ontological request and demand. Let me put it this way. Whatever a thing is in need of, and demands by nature, then that is its request and demand, but in an ontological language. And Allah the Exalted says in this regard, everyone in the heavens and the earth asks him. Every day he is in a different state. يَسْأَلُهُ مَنْ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ كُلَّ يَوْمٍ هُوَ فِي شَأْنٍ. Whoever and everyone in the heavens and the earth there is asks him. كُلَّ يَوْمٍ هُوَ فِي شَأْنٍ. Every day he is in a different state. And that